844-1777 is our local number. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Big week at the Vermont Legislature. We're going to get a preview of coming attractions here, and we'll also talk some national politics as well, too. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to political analyst Eric Davis, professor emeritus from Middlebury College. Happy New Year, my friend.
Good morning, and Happy New Year to you, too, Mark.
How are you? How's 2015 going so far?
So far, so good.
Yeah.
You know, it's only 4 days, 5 days in, but I think we're off to a good start.
You know, a lot can happen in 4 days. You know, you can kind of mess up a whole year and very quickly.
Yep.
I want to talk about some, let's talk about the Vermont legislature here first. And I want to talk about, one of the first orders of business is going to be electing the governor of Vermont. Scott Milne just put up a day or two ago here a piece on Facebook where he talks about the Vermont Constitution. Eric, I want to run this and then let's chat about where things stand and what is in all likelihood going to happen on Thursday.
Vermonters are not going to have a governor until January 8th is because that's the way the Vermont Constitution was written by our founding fathers. And I think it's important to remember that it's the same document, Constitution, that was one of the first on the planet to abolish slavery. I believe the first constitution in the New World to separate property ownership from the right to vote, and has done a lot of other great things. Governor Shumlin is the second incumbent in the last 150 years to find himself in this position. The last incumbent was Madeline Cunin about 30 years ago. She won by 9 points over the second place finisher. This is a point and a quarter difference. Legislature will decide on January 8th. Whether Scott Milne or Peter Shumlin is going to lead the state for the next 2 years. If you ask why I think the Constitution is the way it is and that Vermont's relatively unique, if not unique compared to the rest of the country, I don't know. But I think it's a good thing in 2014 and 2015 that we have this opportunity for folks to look back on the election, look at what's happened between November 4th and today, and just have one more opportunity to talk to your legislators. It's their decision. It's leadership, number one, I believe, for legislators. It's something that they really need to decide what's best for Vermont. I'd encourage you to give them a call if you think Scott Milne's going to be a better governor than Peter Shumlin.
That was a posting that Scott Milne put up on his Facebook page. So, Eric, he says that this is good to have this this second opportunity here. You're not a really big fan of this system here, are you?
If no, so, how no. Come, and, how and you come? Know, I've talked about it with you. I've talked about it with other members of the media. And my argument about this, Mark, is that this provision, which dates back to the first Vermont Constitution in 1777, is really now a historical anachronism. Back in 1777, yes, the Vermont Constitution did all those good things that Scott Milne talked about, abolished slavery, eliminated property qualifications for voting, and so forth. But the general understanding in the late 18th century about democracy was very different than it is today. The notion of an executive who was directly elected by the public was something that, not just here in Vermont, but all over the newly independent United States, was viewed with a great deal of skepticism. Because executives were seen as potential tyrants. George III and the memories of the Revolution were still fresh in many people's minds. There were no political parties to organize elections. So what the framers of the Vermont Constitution in 1777, who copied their idea from the post-independence Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, what they wanted, in effect, was a system in which the voters would prepare a short list of three candidates, and the legislator would then choose the governor from that short list. Well, in the approximately 240 years since the Vermont Constitution was written, the notion of where executives fit in the political system, notions of democracy, that's all changed. Political parties organizing elections and all of that. So, you know, my view, and again, I've talked about this with you and with others, is that for this coming election, the legislature should vote for the person who came in first, which is Peter Shumlin. That's the historical precedent since 1853, when we got the two-party system with Republicans and Democrats. It's my view that the vote should be taken in public by a roll call, not on a secret ballot, and I hope some member of the legislature moves on Thursday that the vote be done through a roll call. And then the legislature should get down to work on amending the Constitution to come up with a different way of electing the governor. There's three ways of doing it. All of them have advantages and disadvantages. You could have plurality election, where whoever gets the most votes wins. You could have a runoff requirement that if no one gets a certain percentage of the vote, 40, 45, 50, whatever it is, the top two candidates have a runoff 2 to 4 weeks later. Or you could have ranked choice voting, that is instant runoff voting. As I said, there's arguments in favor of and against all three of those alternatives. I think the legislature should move promptly on getting a constitutional amendment in the works so we can modernize this particular aspect of the Vermont political system.
Why is having the Vermont legislature decide this on Thursday any different than doing a runoff?
Because the governor is elected by the public as a whole. And the notion of one branch of government electing another branch, I mean, you know, again, we go way back to the founding. And, the idea of an executive who owes his or her office to the legislature really isn't consistent with the notion of separation of powers and each branch resting on its own independent relationship with the people. So I really think this system is, and you know, I think it is significant that, you know, Vermont is the only state that has this. Mississippi has a variant of it where if no one gets a majority, the state house elects the governor. But 48 states have the governor elected directly by the people in some way or other, and I think there's something to be said for the fact that 48 out of 50 do it one way and only Vermont and Mississippi do it the other way.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're making me a little nervous, though, when you start talking about provisions that are not relevant today in the Constitution, because you know and I know that there are people that would love to say, for example, on a national level, put a little curb in things like, oh, freedom of the press. So, you know, do you really want to open this can of worms?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we're not talking about a Bill of Rights. We're not talking here about personal liberties, civil liberties, anything like that. We're talking about something with the structure of government where times have changed since 1777.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Given that the law or that the Constitution is how it is today,
mm-hmm.
Has Scott Milne been wrong in how he's handled the post-election?
I wouldn't say he's been wrong. What I would say in my criticism with him, with all due respect, is that through a sort of practice of common law, of historical precedent, certain understandings get developed. And he has approached this differently from any other gubernatorial candidate since 1853, when the contemporary two-party system became established in Vermont. And I guess that's my disagreement with him. I think this is a historical question that should be considered as settled, and to approach it differently is not consistent with the Vermont political tradition of the last 160 years now.
Is it a problem on a practical level, though?
Well, I mean, what do you mean by that, Mark?
Well, I mean, does it make any difference in terms of the functioning of government?
In terms of the functioning of government, I mean, in some ways it does, because, I mean, let's just say hypothetically Milne were elected. He'd have to form an administration immediately. Now, he says it'd be a slam dunk to find people to work for him. Well, it's not going to be that easy. I mean, you can't, you know, staff up these positions in a day. You have to interview people and set up search committees and things like that. The same thing with putting together a budget. It's not something you can do just in a week. Some administration has started working on it back in the fall. Usually when there's a transition in the governorship, such as from Douglas to Shumlin or from Dean to Douglas, that transition takes place over a two-month period, and the new governor can prepare to take office.
Let's take some calls. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. We go to Montpelier. Thomas, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And I would like to dispute Mr. David's assertion that historically the vote has gone to the candidate with the plurality. I analyzed The 11 elections decided by the General Assembly from 1974 to present, the previous one was before 1912, was 1912, so, and in those 11 elections, in nine of them, the same person had the plurality, who also had the most votes in the most districts. So there were only two cases in those 11 where one person had the plurality and the other had the most votes from the most districts. And those two split. 2010, Chumwin had the plurality, and he was elected. And in 1976, the lieutenant governor's race, it was very close, but T. Gary Buckley had a slight edge in the most votes in the most districts, and he's the one who was elected. So one can just as easily say that the General Assembly, the Joint Assembly, was voting for the person who had the most votes in the most districts. And in three of those cases, the distribution of votes, including the one in which Madeline Cunin was elected, was very close to what the distribution would have been had the legislators voted for the person who had the most votes in the most districts. And none of them got a 180-0 election, which would be what would be expected if it was the person with the statewide plurality getting elected.
All right, let me have Eric comment on
that. All right,
thank
you. Those are very good points, and you've obviously spent a lot of time researching this. I would make two points in return. First of all, in my view, now I was not living in Vermont in 1976 when you had the contested lieutenant governor election between Alden and Buckley. So my knowledge of that is based on reading news accounts of it. I think the reason, a principal reason why T. Gary Buckley, the second place finisher, ended up being elected by the legislature, is that John Alden, the first place finisher, was under investigation by the Attorney General's Office for insurance fraud. An offense for which he was subsequently convicted. It was known in inside circles in Montpelier, but was not known to the public that the Attorney General was investigating Mr. Alden. So legislators used this inside knowledge, so to speak, as one reason to put the second place finisher, Gary Buckley, into the office. I think it's also interesting to note that when Gary Buckley ran for re-election in 1978, he ended up losing the Republican primary to Peter Smith, in part because some voters thought his election to the office 2 years earlier had been illegitimate. As to the question of who wins the most districts, with all due respect, Tom, I think that question is irrelevant because the governor represents the whole state. The governor doesn't represent individual districts. Vermont doesn't have an electoral college-type system. Chumwin had more votes than Milne statewide. Yes, if you look at the distribution of the votes, if you take out the city of Burlington, he did win, Milne did win more votes in 250 of the state's 251 communities. But that's not the way the votes are counted. The votes are counted in the aggregate statewide. So those are my responses.
Let's go to St. Albans. Dick, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Mark. Happy New Year.
You too.
Your guest there is correct on the voting for someone with the most votes. But Section 58 on impeachment and maladministration gives this legislature full authority to dump someone.
All right.
Of maladministration is on the table here, and this was discussed in a meeting up in St. Albans Saturday morning with the legislators, that in order to have a legitimate reason and not to vote for someone, you've got to have legitimate charges against him.
And what would the maladministration charge be?
Lying to the legislature, breaking the law, hiring basically a criminal to institute this health care plan, which is going to be proven, and most likely Mr. Gruber is going to go to jail. Multiple charges of maladministration here, and a loss of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money.
What was the lying to the legislature?
Not coming forward with the information needed that they requested under a law they provided for him to come forward to show how he was going to finance his plan.
Okay. All right, let me have Eric comment on that. Thank you for your call.
Okay. I mean, first of all, I'll open by saying, and again, Mark, we talked about this many times. I was on your show before the election. I had some serious criticisms of Peter Shumlin before the campaign, having to do with his campaign finance. I mentioned the same point your last caller did about not providing the financing plan by the statutory deadline and so forth. However, the voters had that information available to them. And in the aggregate, more voters voted for Peter Shumlin than for Scott Mill. Now, your caller mentions impeachment. That is an opportunity available to the legislature. I don't think it's something that's going to happen in the next 2 years. But it is there, theoretically. And as for Mr. Gruber, I think the auditor's office and perhaps the attorney general's office will investigate his contracts and decide whether any sanctions are appropriate.
Let's go to Barry. Jim, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I had a question regarding historical precedent of legislators being directed by their districts informally by a particular poll, such in this case, the governor is elected by the people, but the legislators are elected by a particular district. And to a certain extent, this is obviously an old argument, but they're beholden to that district. So I'm wondering if there's any historical precedent, not just in the runoff gubernatorial and lieutenant governor elections, but in general, where the legislature decided to follow the dictates of their districts based on a vote. That's one question. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you introduced the idea that in, I think it was 1976, lieutenant governor's election, that the legislature was able to make, for lack of a better term, a moral judgment of who would be the better candidate. I think that opens a can of worms here that I'm not sure you want to open. So I'll just leave that there and see what your comments are. I'll go listen to the radio.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. I'll take the 2 points. On legislators voting with their districts, I mean, that's, in a sense, legislators do that on issues, but sometimes they don't. Scott Mill's own mother may have run into that issue. Marion Mill, when she was in the legislature, she voted for the Civil Unions Bill in 1999 and was defeated for re-election in the Republican primary in 2000. I would like to get back, though, to something I mentioned at the beginning, Mark, and that is that I hope that this vote on Thursday is taken by public roll call rather than on secret ballot, so that the voters know how their legislators voted, and if voters disagree with how their legislators voted for governor, well, the next election is in 2 years, and they can take that into account.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they're going to do that or not?
I hope someone makes the motion. I hope there's a debate on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And does all it take is one person raising it?
I think so. This is sort of unprecedented, but I believe that Phil Scott, as president of the Senate, is the presiding officer of the Joint Assembly. An individual member could it's not required in statute that the vote be taken by secret ballot. Secretary of State Jim Condos, who will actually supervise the election, says it's precedent and historical. So I think an individual legislator could stand up and make a motion that the vote be taken by roll.
244-1777, that's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. Wow, okay, Eric Davis is very popular this morning. Let's get back to some calls here. Let's head over to Waitsfield. Fred, good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Davis, our legislature takes great pride in being first in the nation. So why all of this talk about precedents? And I'll stand by.
Why all the talk about precedents? Sometimes being first in the nation isn't necessarily a good idea. We've seen a number of examples in recent years where the Vermont legislature has passed a statute which they've claimed is first in the nation, and then it's been turned down by federal courts on a number of reasons. That may happen again with GMO labeling. I think a certain set of understandings that get established through practice over the past 160 years or so is not to be disregarded lightly.
I understand your argument. It just seems ironic that the legislature takes such pride in being different, and then all of a sudden, now, they want to go with tradition and everything. I just find it ironic.
Well, that's an observation, I'll let you make that observation.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
Thanks for your call. Let's head over to Essex. Reg, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, just a quick question. Is there only three states that do vote by the legislature?
There's only two. In Vermont, where the whole legislature would do it, and Mississippi, where if no one gets 50%, the State House of Representatives does it.
So there's only three states?
No, two.
There's two.
Two.
Vermont
only
and Mississippi.
Two.
Yeah. Only two, Vermont and Mississippi.
Yeah, don't you? It's probably about time they change that law.
I agree with you.
Yeah, because there's only two states. I mean, what's going on? Yeah. So, okay, that's my question. That's all.
Thanks for your
call. Thank you.
So, Eric, let me make sure I understand this. So, what's the worst case scenario? What's the problem that needs to be fixed?
The problem that needs to be fixed is that the public, not the legislature, should elect the governor. And there are three ways of doing it. You can have the person who gets the most votes win. You can have the public vote in a runoff between the top two finishes if no one makes a certain threshold, whether it's 50, 40, or some number in between. Or you can have ranked choice voting, instant runoff vote. But in any one of those three systems, it's the people who choose the governor and not the legislature.
Let's go to Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hey, listen, just a little statement of some advocacy here, because I think it's kind of objectionable that the legislature can step in between us and our votes and the governor or the lieutenant governor or who is that, the treasurer?
The treasurer is the other office.
There's two things we can deal with here all in one fell swoop, and one of them, I think, is to go to a runoff system, and my preference is to instant runoff voting. I think it solves a lot of issues. It's not perfect, but it's well ahead of second place. And the other issue is back in 2000 in Bush v. Gore, we found out through the Supreme Court rulings that there is no federally guaranteed right to vote. And we can put that into the state constitution, too, that guarantees our individual right to vote, to participate. So, thanks.
Right. Okay. Thanks for your call. Eric, anything you want to comment on?
Just on the instant runoff point, I have not heard Milne make, in effect, the instant runoff voting argument recently, but he was making it very shortly after the votes were counted in November, although not using the phrase instant runoff voting. But back then, Milne argued that if you added together the votes of Dan Feliciano and Scott Milne, you'd get a number that was higher than Peter Shumlin. And Milne, in effect, was saying that, well, the people who voted for Feliciano, their second choice was probably me rather than Shumlin. So if you add together Feliciano's votes and my votes, it's more than Shumlin. And that's a plausible argument. In recent weeks, he hasn't talked much about that, and he's talked more about this legislative duty to make an independent judgment and so forth. But in my view, I think if he wanted to make a case, if Milne wanted to make a case for instant runoff voting, he could. Now, that argument can also be on the other shoe, so that's a bad metaphor, but you know what I mean. Imagine the following scenario 2 years from now, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Say we have a progressive running a serious campaign for governor. And say the Republican finishes first with, let's say, hypothetically, 47% of the vote. And the Democrat finishes second with 45% of the vote. And the progressive gets 8% of the vote. And the Democrat says, well, I finished second, but if you add together my vote and the progressive vote, that means the majority of the voters didn't want a Republican governor, even though the Republican finished first.
Mm-hmm.
And you Democrats in the legislature should vote for me rather than the first place Republican, because the progressive and Democratic vote is considerably bigger than the Republican vote.
We're talking with political analyst Eric Davis. Let me ask you, let's open up another couple of topics here. The governor's decision to not pursue funding for a single-payer plan.
Yep.
How does that change the 2015 session?
Well, health care is not going to be a big issue. I mean, the speaker had made clear, even before the governor's announcement, that school finance and school governance, K-12, was going to be his top priority for the House in 2015. And this decision makes that even more so, along with the state budget. Now, there may be some attention paid to some health care issues, such as the continued problems with Vermont Health Connect and whether Vermont Health Connect should be expanded in 2016 to the small businesses with 51 to 100 employees. But that's very different from voting on a financing plan for a health care scheme that would affect everyone in the whole state. So taking single-payer off the table for the 2015-16 session means that education, finance, and the state budget really come to the fore as the top issues.
Let's go back to the phone here. Eudora, good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I'm out right there.
Okay. All right. We'll wait for you.
Okay. I'm fine. I hate to go on, but I just want to say this. I don't have a listed number, and Mr. Shelburne called me, well, the girls from his place, and wished me Merry Christmas. And my number's not listed, and I voted for him. And I really hope he gets elected. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Okay.
Happy New Year, Mark.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, Eudora. All right, let's go to Burlington. Morris, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Morris Mahoney here. You just happened to get into the issues facing the legislature, and I'm sure you'll be talking about education. And
no, not at all.
There's a lot of talk, but not a lot of facts. So I have two questions. One, what is the property tax crisis? In Vermont, if you're making $90,000 a year joint income, you have, homestead rebate.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody with a low income should be getting a pretty generous rebate from the state for their town. So who is suffering on property taxes other than wealthy people with second homes or people with very high incomes and really valuable homes?
Okay.
The second question that comes up all the time with funding to education is all of the increases. Why are there all these increases? Well, one of the reasons they've increased so much is the very people who are complaining about them, the legislators, have passed in the last 20 years 200 unfunded mandates for public education. That same legislature has taken the education fund and used it to fund daycare. So if you're sending kids to the Y, that comes out of the education fund. They also are now using the education fund to pay for education funding in corrections. So I every 7 years or so, it's like the plague of locusts. They come around and they need a new formula and everything else. But then they start robbing and chipping away at the formula they've created, and then they've got to create a new one. So I'm just hoping that any legislators you have on talking about education will tell you who is suffering from property taxes in Vermont and explain why they keep passing these unfunded mandates.
Well, doesn't your second point make the first point? Isn't what they're doing in the legislature exacerbating the property tax problem?
Absolutely. But you know they're going to probably get into another whole new formula, and you know, I think you and I have probably seen six of these phases go through, and every time they get
Thanks.
A new formula, they start chipping away at it and adding more mandates.
Yeah,
and then they say, oh my gosh. You know, and they'll use the figure, well, Vermont has the lowest class per, you know, average in the nation. Well, if you're a teacher and you've got 24 kids in your class, but you've got a special educator in there with one student, that brings it down to 12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they include in the average, I think they might include librarians, but I'm pretty sure they include guidance counselors and everything else. So the actual class average in Vermont for a full-time classroom teacher is not anywhere near 10.
Okay, let me get Eric to comment on that.
All right, I'd like to comment on on several of Morris's points.
Okay.
Let me interrupt you, though,
just for a second here. We're going to take a quick break here before you get into your answer here.
We'll come back,
continue our discussion with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Middlebury College. We'll be back talking more locusts right after this.
Hi, I'm John Noyce, and I invite you to join me weekday mornings and Saturdays, too, for the original buy, sell, trade, and swap program, The Trading Post. We take your phone calls Monday through Wednesday at 6:35 a.m., and the mailbag edition Thursday through Saturday. Eric Michaels is even in on Saturdays with a bonus edition at 8 a.m. So if you've got items to sell, items you're looking for, even things to give away, tune into The Trading Post 6 days a week on your news and sports leader, WDEV AM and FM, Radio Vermont.
Our next guest has been a major star since, well, the beginning of time, literally. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to The Sun. Son, how do you manage to look so amazing at a zillion years old?
Clean living, Jimmy. And I keep very busy. Folks are now using my energy to power their lives, heat their homes, and fuel their cars.
You're producing like a kabazillion megawatts, right? That's crazy.
All in a day's work, Jimmy. In Vermont alone, I'm now providing the power to generate electricity for thousands and thousands of households.
Why, son, that's heartwarming.
Not just hearts, Jimmy. Heads, fingers, toes.
That's great, son. More fun with the sun after this break.
SunCommon helps Vermonters go solar with no upfront costs and a low fixed monthly payment. And with the best solar panels provided by industry leader SunPower, heating your home with solar power has never made more sense. Energy from the sun is clean, reliable, affordable, and SunCommon makes it easy to save money and go solar. Check out SunCommon.com.
244-1777, our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. You're also welcome anytime you want to email me questions. Let me take a moment, too, to remind you about our good friends at Green Mountain Access. That's where you can reach me, Mark, M-A-R-K, at gmavt.net. If you'd like to sign up for services with the folks at Green Mountain Access, call them today at 1-888-321-0815 and on the web, gmavt.net. So, Eric, where's the problem with property taxes
and these unfunded mandates? A few points there. First of all, even the households that are eligible for the income sensitivity program, their property taxes keep going up every year. Second, the income sensitivity program only applies to the homestead and a small amount of land. So, if you are a property owner who owns a large property, even though your home is subject to income sensitivity, most of your land is not, and the property tax on the land can go up quite a bit year over year. And third, one of the groups that's most adversely affected by the current system are those households whose income is just over the cutoff for income sensitivity, which is $90,000. Now, if you have two people who each make between $40,000 and $60,000 a year, for a total of $100,000 income, they're not subject to income sensitivity. Over here in Addison County, that household is probably paying somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 a year in property tax if they live in an average-sized home. So that's between 5 and 6% of their income. The households eligible for income sensitivity that have an income of just $10,000 less are paying between 2.5% and 3%. So when your household income crosses that $90,000 line, the percentage of your income you pay in property tax can go up quite a bit. So there are groups being adversely affected by the current system. Second, about controlling education costs, there was a good story I saw. It was reported in WCAX that two school districts in the White River Valley are considering consolidating. One is the Orange-Windsor District, and the other one is the Windsor Northwest District. These districts are in the towns, if I can recall, of Rochester, Stock, Bethel, South Royalton, Tunbridge, and Chelsea. And there happen right now to be four high schools in those two supervisory unions, one in Rochester, one in Bethel, one in Chelsea, and one in South Royalton. And those are all pretty small high schools. And it may be that four high schools is too many for that district, but I'm not sure about that. But you have to also look at the geography. There's mountains in the middle of that district. To get from Rochester to Bethel, for example, you'd have to go over Bethel Mountain Gap or drive down to Stockbridge and come back up. Chelsea down to South Royalton in the winter is not an easy commute either. So how do you trade off having the small high schools close to somewhat geographically isolated communities with maybe having larger buildings where you could have larger class sizes and so forth? But none of the four existing buildings is so big that if you closed another one, you could just move all these students from that other school in. So that those are examples of the complicated questions that come up when you think about consolidation and combining districts.
Let's go to Corinth Forbes. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good.
Going back, I missed an earlier discussion on Wednesday's outcome. Speaking of history, this is apt to put another notch in Vermont's history after Wednesday. But I got a question. If legislators who are going to vote, if it's done by secret ballot, of course, it's going to be difficult to know how that person voted. It might allow somebody, even on the Democratic side, to vote for Mill, and that'll protect them. But if it's opened, or it's been known, how would this affect down the road that legislator's ability to run for elected office again if he voted, let's say, against his constituent?
Mm-hmm. We talked about this a little bit, but maybe Eric has some thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, I think the vote should be by roll call, and if in 2 years there's a voter in a district who does not like the way his or her legislator voted on the election of governor and wants to vote for someone else for the legislature, in my mind, that's a perfectly legitimate reason for doing so.
Thank you, Forbes. Appreciate your call. 244-1777, our local number. Toll free, 877-291-8255. You know, Eric, I can't remember a legislative session where lawmakers haven't gone back with a fill-in-the-blank gap financially.
Yep.
I mean, usually it isn't triple digits. So how big a deal is this? I mean, it seems like we worry about it, and then magically it goes away.
This one seems more serious than most, because I think the problem is the state budget trends are just not sustainable over the long term. State spending has been increasing at about 5% a year for the last couple of years, and the overall state economy and thus state revenues is growing at about 3% a year. And when you have that 2% gap, you have a $100 million gap, and the next year it's 120, the next year it's a little bit bigger, and so forth. So I think what the legislature has to do is really look at the serious examination of programs and do some things to put the budget in a more sustainable state over the longer term of bringing the rate of increase of state spending more in line with the overall growth in the state economy.
Mm-hmm. How easy is it to cut that 2%, do you think?
It's not easy. It's not easy. But again, we had the discussion of education. I think one question which is legitimate to consider is K-12 education as a program receiving the appropriate amount of support compared with other programs in the state budget? I mean, again, if you look at Vermont compared with other states, we devote very little to private higher to public higher education. Now, granted, some people may say I'm biased on this since I've worked in the higher education sector for close to 40 years, private sector rather than public, but still in higher education. But, you know, are we perhaps spending a little too much on K-12 and not enough on UVM and the Vermont State Colleges and other higher education? That's a legitimate question. Human services programs. Are there ways of reorganizing the delivery of human services programs that breaks down some of the silos and independent agencies and combining what are now some separate programs into larger programs to provide families with support from sort of different disciplines and different professions might also save some money at the same time? So those are the sorts of questions I think the legislature should be looking at.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time this morning. I appreciate it very much, as always.
My pleasure, Mark.
Happy 2015. Political analyst Eric Davis, longtime professor at Middlebury College, professor emeritus at that private institution. That's going to wrap things up for today. We'll continue our discussion about the 2015 legislative session on the program tomorrow, as well as the rest of the week. I'll be broadcasting live at the State House on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Joining us in the studio tomorrow, we'll talk with reporters Ann Galloway and John Walters. Have a great day. Come back and join us same time, same place tomorrow, right here on these great radio stations. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugar Bush in the flagship AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is coming your way next.